Welcome to the Trade Show Podcast, the home for conversations with global leaders in the trade show and events business. Our show will bring you face to face with experts who speak about the possibilities and trajectories of this $50 billion industry. I'm your host, Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation visitor engagement platform, where our mission is to make conversion easy. Welcome to this episode of the Trade Show Podcast. Thank you for listening and your continued feedback. If you have suggestions or you want me to dig in with a specific guest, please write to me at shubhanjan@pitch.link or message me on LinkedIn. Both links available in the show notes. Our guest today is Larry Kulhavik, a seasoned leader in the global trade show and exhibit design industry with over 45 years of experience specializing in international face-to-face marketing.
So the power of trade shows is the element of emotion and how it is that we attend the show, we see new things, we meet old peers, and we gain some knowledge and perhaps find something we were looking for that created what I call a eureka moment. Eureka! I discovered this new process that helped my company, blah, 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 and came back and actually made a difference.
Larry's career spans leadership roles at three of the top US exhibit design firms, Exhibit Group, Dersay, and 3D Exhibits. He also authored two books, The Invisible Industry, The Evolution of Trade Shows, A $1 trillion Secret, and The Trade Shows from One Country to the Next, a widely respected guide detailing exhibit strategies and cultural insights across 45 countries. Now let's deep dive into this session with Larry Kulhavik. Larry, welcome to the Trade Show Podcast. I am delighted that we could get over the hump that we faced yesterday and I could have you back today morning. Thank you for joining us.
Well, technical difficulties always happen.
Yes.
So good morning here in Denver, Colorado.
You're welcome to this show and I'm delighted actually to talk about your book, The Invisible Industry. And it's an interesting book. It's an intriguing cover, but we'll get there in a bit. What actually made you decide that this book needs to be written?
Well, I spent my entire life doing trade shows, 52 years. Mm. I retired 5 years ago and couldn't stop thinking about what I did for 50 years. I really should just have spent all my time golfing and enjoying life, but I just continued to think about what I fumbled into. And I say fumbled, because most people who discovered the trade show industry fell into it. They didn't intend to be, you don't go to school to learn how to do it. Mm-hmm. I changed that, by the way, but I will talk about that later. But after all those years, I said, you know, we spent all this time, and I say we, I have a co-author, Bob McCarthy, and he also spent 50 years. And Bob McClinsey. And so we got together, and he is an historian. He writes for the Exhibit City News, which is a pretty popular magazine here in the United States, a regular column. I used to write for them, but I stopped. But his writing has to do with the history and how did this all happen. So I got together with him and said, you write about how it all happened, and I'll write how it was for the past 50 years, and we'll join together and conclude with what's the future. Hmm. So that truly the what pushed us to write the book was a study that came out by the Exhibit City Council, actually hired by the Oxford Economics Group. And they came to the conclusion that our industry worldwide was $1.6 trillion. I said, wow. 1.6, you've got to be kidding. Now, in their defense, they measured all meetings beyond trade shows. It wasn't just trade shows or events. It was anybody who had 10 people in a business that went on a business trip in a hotel was considered a meeting, and they are all included. So you could see where that number got. But the United States is truly up there as well. And so is the whole world. Now, COVID really set us back. But we recovered, and I say we, the industry, very quickly. And it's remarkable on how virtual trade shows and all these things that came about that perhaps were going to replace trade shows really didn't happen as effectively as they hoped they would. And the question is, why is that? You know, why is it that our industry came back so quickly and powerfully? And it's an easy answer. And the answer is emotion. Face-to-face communication has to do with creating emotion. And when you create emotion, your decision to buy is influenced greatly. Now, what we're doing right now is through the internet. One thing you're not seeing is me moving my hands here. You're not seeing me looking at my telephone as everybody is. Have you been on Zoom calls and everybody on the Zoom call is doing this and they're listening at the same time? Now imagine if I was with you at dinner and I was on my, and you're talking and I'm on my phone. That's an insult, but we do it on Zoom calls all the time. It's okay. So the power of trade shows is the element of emotion and how it is that we attend the show, we see new things, we meet old peers, and we gain some knowledge and perhaps find something we were looking for that created what I call a eureka moment. Eureka! I discovered this new process that helped my company, blah, 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 and came back and actually made a difference. Now, the question was, how did trade shows start? And Bob, my co-author, is truly a historian who starts with the world fairs and the world fairs of Europe primarily.
Right.
And it obviously came to the United States in due time. But at world fairs, there were no specific industries. It was anything that was new, anything that could be presented as innovative. And so many of the most famous discoveries and inventors introduced themselves at world fairs. And their products became such that they were world renowned, from Heinz ketchup to Thomas Edison to Otis Elevator. I don't know if you heard of Otis Elevator. He invented the elevator. And it has its ups and downs in that industry, of course. But at the same time, those emotions that kicked in innovation and or change and people bought the ideas evolved eventually to be industry specific. And one of the most industry specific shows was electric. It was the first. Bicycles was another one where they had their own industry show. Now, these shows eventually in the 1900s came to the United States and really evolved here at that time, probably 1910, 20, where it kicked into gear, where industries, associations, that is, created their own trade shows and created their own events. So that's really where, for the United States, trade shows evolved, as they did in the rest of the world. This isn't unique to the United States. In fact, the rest of the world was doing this, in Europe in particular, long before the Americans discovered trade shows as this miraculous emotion-generating marketplace. And really, that's what it is.
Absolutely. I mean, you're so right, because I don't know how many people know that the Eiffel Tower was constructed for a world fair.
Absolutely.
And it was supposed to be taken down.
Right.
After it. And then they said, hey,
this is pretty cool.
It's pretty cool. Let's keep it there. And it's still there after nearly 150 years.
Yes. Yeah. And it's a landmark. As the Statue of Liberty was given to the United States by France. But there are a lot of landmarks that remained after the World Fair. One of the people I studied under was a guy by the name of Buckminster Fuller. Look him up. He is one of the most innovative thinkers in the world. And I went to Southern Illinois University, and he was professor there. And he gave monthly lectures. He was world known, but he created the geodesic domes. And at the Montreal World's Fair, they hired him to do the U.S. Pavilion, of which was a gigantic geodesic dome. And within it was innovation within the United States. Now, that idea after that fair came to Disney World in Orlando. There's the same dome. But that concept really triggered a lot of imaginative thinking. And his influence on me wasn't geodesic domes. It was his method of thinking through a problem. Mm. How do we solve a design problem? And there's a process. And that was his magic more than what he invented. It's how he came about inventing things, because he did much more beyond geodesic domes. And I don't want to get into Buckminster Fuller, but he influenced me on how to think. Now, when I graduated from Southern Illinois University, I had to get a job now. And what experience did I have? I have a degree in design, studied with Fuller doing domes. I fumbled into the trade show industry. I met someone and said, hey, you know, I ought to go to McCormick Place and design exhibits for them. You're a designer. And that's what I did. And that was in 1971, got a job designing exhibits. McCormick Place had just burned down 2 years before then, and they rebuilt McCormick Place. So everybody needed a new exhibit, especially for the houseware show, which is the show that burned to the ground. And so that's how it started. I fumbled in, and you ask anybody who spent any more than 20 years in the industry, and they'll tell you, this is not something I intended to do. And they fumbled into it. Part of what I'm writing in the book, too, is echoing the experiences of others who have fumbled into it and very successful in what they did in their time. And it's something that I felt very strongly. I also went to school, the University of Illinois, to learn to be an architect. And then I went Southern Illinois, and the degree is in design. But my mother used to always say to me, Larry, when are you going to be an architect? This is after I'm designing exhibits, as though that wasn't good enough, you know. Surely it was good enough. And I said, Mom, I am an architect. The only thing is that the buildings I build, I set them up and I take them down. They don't stay up. And it is something I've been proud of what I fumbled into and was very much involved within my industry throughout my career. I worked for the largest exhibit company in the United States. It was owned by the Greyhound Corporation. It was called Greyhound Exhibit Group, and they had Greyhound Exposition, which was another company they owned. And with that was the first company that was actually on the stock market. Most exhibit companies were just entrepreneurs. There were carpenters and designers who started up a company. Two or three guys got together and said, hey, we can build exhibits just as good as anybody. And that's really, they were not businessmen, and that was their fault. In due time, they did learn to be businessmen. But in the start, and I'm talking about the 1960s, exhibit companies flourished throughout the United States. And observing this as a student and finding my way, I became the president of the Exhibit Designer Producer Association for a year. And then I was asked to be president, and then the first American president, of IFES, the International Federation of Exhibition Services Companies. And their focus was, how do we get world companies to partner to help foreign companies when they come to a country outside of their country. And with all of that experience triggered my first book, which was How to Do Trade Shows from One Company to the Next. How do you act differently when you go to another country culturally and follow the rules of that organization or that country region? And the book has 45 different countries, and it was not written by me. No one person is the expert everywhere in the world. I reached out because I was president of IFES. I met all the owners of exhibit companies all over the world. And I asked them after I was concluded as president, tell me, when I come to your country, how should I act differently? What should I do differently as an American in particular? And they quickly responded. I was surprised how quickly every one of them from France and Saudi Arabia and Japan and China all responded. And these are owners of companies, so they know what they're talking about. I'm saying, what do I do for differently in your country? And with that information, I put a format together and shared their thoughts, and I have to believe what they told me is right, into a book. And I'm now in the process of redoing the book because it's too thick and too many countries, and I want to do it by regions, five regions of the world. Here's how you act differently in that region. Well, today that's not what we're talking about, but I'm sharing with you.
That's fine, and I would love to have you back because, you know, this is very interesting. At this point, in my day job, I'm partnering with a company which does literally that for Indian exhibitors going and exhibiting all over the world.
Ah, you'll have to tell me who that company is off the air because I probably know them.
Okay. Yes. So I would love to have that conversation. Coming back to the invisible industry,
right?
When you and your co-author, you decided the format, what was the next process? How long did it take you to write this book? What was your writing process? How were you exchanging the chapters that you were writing and reviewing it? Tell me a bit about that.
Yes. Well, it wasn't as easy as we thought, quite frankly. We both have different writing styles. His were more to the point and storytelling. And if you read chapters 1 through 5, basically about all the world fairs, it's every chapter's a story. And how did that story beginning, a middle, and an end? And mine were more things that happened, not necessarily in the same order. So as he was writing his chapters, and we decided you write about the history and I'll write about what happened after basically 1960 is when what I'm talking about kicked into gear. Now that's 7 decades almost. And I talk in terms of decades, what happened during those periods of time and how did things change? And he, because I came from the design and management, and Bob was involved with installation dismantling, and he got involved with management as well. But we had two different paths in our journey through trade shows. It wasn't the same, which was good because we fed on each other's strengths and weaknesses. Right. So Bob wrote his portion. I wrote mine, and then there are three portions where we joined together. And where we joined together was, how is it that this industry got to be $1 trillion? How did that happen? And what the economic impact in the United States, as I said earlier, there were two studies, the exhibit EIC, which is the Events Industry Council, and there's a group here in the United States called SEER, the Center for Exhibition Research. Their methodology is totally different. They don't measure all businesses and all meetings in the United States. They measure only trade shows. And when I say trade shows, B2B, business to business. They don't measure B2C, which is like the auto show, the RV show, the boat show. Those are public shows that are advertised and attract the masses from anywhere. Where trade shows are private, you're invited. You're not, and they're not advertised. You don't see a big advertisement for the consumer electronics show or the houseware show. And this is where the title, The Invisible Industry, comes from. Nobody knows all this activities taking place because it's not advertised. And unless you're in the industry, you really don't know either. I know you're in the industry as well. And I can say anytime you go to a cocktail party or a get together, people will say, well, what do you do for a living, Larry? And I say, I do trade shows. You know, what is that? And I say, the auto show. Oh, yeah, I know the auto show. that they can relate to. But that when you say the word trade show, it doesn't ring a bell with the general public unless you were part of it. Now, the irony to what I'm saying in my book, one of the people I worked for, her name was Lene Kitzing, and she developed a pie chart that determined what percentage of your marketing budget is given to there. She breaks it into seven components, of which trade shows is one. And the rule of thumb in determining a marketing budget is 5% of your overall revenue should be dedicated to marketing. So of that money that's in the 5%, it's divided into seven components, one of which is trade shows, the other is the internet, B2B advertising. There are, look in the book, and there's of the seven. But of those seven, the biggest piece of the pie is trade shows.
Yes.
I mean, it's hugely bigger amount of money that is dedicated to it, of which companies are approving that budget. Now, the internet is playing, it's cutting into that big time. And but between those two, that's some big money. So when you're spending big money on a piece of marketing called trade shows, you better be proving to me what we're getting for it if I'm a CEO or I'm a CFO. And that whole measurement strategy has really permeated throughout the industry now, which thank God it did. Because it's important to justify, just because we felt good about a trade show experience doesn't mean it's a good investment in money.
Right.
But it's been proven to be, and it's because we've gone out of our way to figure ways to measure success. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to measure the level of emotion? And the answer is yes. You can measure the level of emotion. And with that, along with what did we sell, that's easy. I used to do an exhibit for a company that sold printing presses. And he said, Larry, if I sell two presses that paid for this and then some. So our strategy was sell two presses. And it paid for everything that, you know, double-deck exhibit. It was like $150,000. But it, not all companies are that easy to measure.
True.
Especially if you're selling a service. And so, but trade shows are measurable, and this is why people continue to invest in them. So the question is, at what point, or is there something that might take its place? Or is there something out there that might be more effective than face-to-face communication? I don't have the answer for that. But in our book, I ask 20 different professionals from our industry, how do you see the future? Where do you see us going? And they all honestly really answered differently, all very positively. But it's like asking my mother, what do you think of our family? You know, you're going to get a positive answer. So be careful who you ask. But at the same time, I have to take what they shared seriously. And they're all pretty positive about the future of our industry. The invisible industry. Again, it's invisible because nobody knows it's going on. It's also invisible in the power and the dollars that it is generating to the economy worldwide, let alone the United States. And the U.S. plays a strong role in trade shows in the world. And the United States, and I point this out in the book, I have an entire chapter, manages a trade show differently than any other country in the world. So the question is, why is it that you manage things so differently, America? Well, Americans have always had I'll tell you how to do it, partner, attitude. I mean, starting from metric to inches. I mean, the whole world measures trade shows in metric. We, like the UK, continue to do in inches and feet. So they talk about square feet. You know, when you sell an exhibit, it's sold by space. It's sold by square feet. That's a big, major difference. The other big difference is how we handle material handling. And there's this dirty word in the industry called drayage. And then in the United States, things are, you charge, when you ship an exhibit to a convention hall, it, number one, it must be unloaded by a teamster, a union person, who takes it off the truck with a forklift and delivers it to your space. You're not allowed to do that yourself. In Europe, they'll pull the truck up right on the floor. The carpenters will pull it off the truck, put it in the space, take it. It's a totally different process. And it's very, very efficient, but it's expensive. And it's measured by weight. Now, back in 1970, when this whole thing, geez, I'm paying $10,000 for drayage to unload stuff. What? This is crazy. So lo and behold, the industry then developed portable exhibits, lightweight exhibits, and changed the weight of exhibits. Fabric is a big thing now. And that stayed with us today. We still have double-deck exhibits. There's no way to make a two-story exhibit lightweight. But they include in that the fabric and other materials that never were aluminum systems that never were used. Now, the book explains all this. Through each decade came some form of change. And somebody drove that change. There's always an individual, an association, organization that pushed it to happen faster. Right. And that is very interesting. And a lot of things that are done throughout the world are copied. And as I said earlier, the United States has its own peculiarities about how we manage a trade show, from drayage to our union regulations and what's important.
You talked about people who moved, who actually led the changes, right? And you have a chapter in part three about change makers and the people who moved the needle. And I think right. This will be a nice segue to talk about a few of them that you have written about in the book.
Absolutely. I mean, there are people that through their actions now changed the way we were naturally doing business. Starting with a guy by the name of Fred Kitzing, who back in the 60s, we sold exhibits and people would buy structures. And exhibits were really the way to present yourself in a fashionable way. It was your image. But he said, we're not selling exhibits. We're selling an attraction. You have to develop an attraction within that exhibit. Just a fancy piece of architecture is not enough. You've got to create an attraction. And your salespeople have to be trained to interact, to engage. And that mentality changed the industry extremely. So Fred Kitzing is one. Another one is a gal by the name of Ingrid Boyd. And she is from Germany. And she was the first woman president of IFAS EDPA. And she represented IFAS. And she was the one who got me involved with IFAS. But her passion about, hey, there's a world out there of exhibits to sell to. United States only sold to ourselves. Why is that so? Because they had more business than they can handle. They didn't need to stretch themselves throughout the world. But lo and behold, in the 70s, they realized, hey, we do need the world. And she was influential in getting American companies, exhibit companies, involved internationally. And now we are very much involved. It started in 2012, believe it or not. It's that we only did 5% of our revenue as an exhibit industry was spent internationally. Now it's 18%. It's right. Still lower than the rest of the world, but it's creeping up quickly. So she was a very strong contributor to that change.
Interesting, yeah.
But and then there are associations within our industry. There are 32 associations within the American trade show industry. In the world, I'd say there are 50-something, but there's so many associations that are dedicated to a niche specialty. You're the Association of Exhibit Installers, the Association of Marketing. of these 32, they are now working together as one, which is really fantastic, because they have to be on the same page to support the industry. But the AIEE, which is the International Association of Exhibits and Events, were very influential in making, when I talk about changes in the United States, some big major change, and this is back in the 60s, that exhibits had to be set back. There was regulations in how far can I build a wall in the space. In Europe, it's called cubic content. You'd build all the way to the end. You can build a total fort around your space. But IE established this new regulation that you can only come one-third forward at 8 foot high or 3 meters. And at that point, you have to drop down to 1 meter high. And the whole purpose for that was, as you were walking down an aisle for inline exhibits in particular, that you can see all the exhibits. Otherwise, you're seeing a straight wall. Right. So that rule stuck, and every show in the United States follows this standard. Also, height limits. And so the regulations that IEEE set back in 1960 created the American way of doing trade shows so differently than the rest of the world. So if you're designing an exhibit from Italy and coming to the United States, you better be conscious of these regulations, because I used to argue constantly with my friends from overseas. Larry, why are they charging me to buy the weight for the freight to come in? And why can't I build my exhibit all the way to the front of the hall? And why can't, you know, you're making absolute sense. But when in Rome, do as the Romans. And this is the rule, and follow the rule. Let's not argue about it, because we're wasting time arguing about what's right and what's wrong. This is just the way the U.S. decided they're managing their events. So do as the Romans do. And that's true. And that's part of my first book, actually. Right. There's many idiosyncrasies for countries throughout the world that you better pay attention to why they do it that way, and don't argue that it does make sense. Because you're right, maybe. And the theme of my first book was, there's no right way, there's no wrong way, there's only a different way. Right. Respect and be aware of what's different, and you're on your way to success.
Absolutely.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break.
In the medical industry in particular, most people who attend a medical conference are really not going there for the exhibits. They're going there to continue their continued education units. They have to go to sessions to get credits to keep their licenses. So that's their main reason. Their second reason is to network with other doctors. And the third reason is the trade show.
You are listening to a Bizcast Audio Original. Podcasting is one of the fastest growing content marketing avenues today. We can help you exploit this largely untapped marketing opportunity. We can craft your audio strategy and leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that smartphone penetration provides. It is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to target audiences. Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for the Trade Show podcast and founder of PitchLink, the visitor engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode.
Let's touch upon the future, because the history and how it evolved, while they're exciting, and I'm sure the readers of the book will get a very deep understanding of that. Where is the industry heading? What is the future?
Well, we all believe that the power of emotion and face-to-face communication is there. So the question is, what can possibly take its place? And with the new generation of I know my children, we go out to dinner and they're on their phones talking to each other. And for them, it's it's okay to communicate this way. Mm. And I find it so disturbing, but that's me because I'm older. Right. I think our new generation's willingness to not be face-to-face is a challenge, but I just can't believe that emotion continues to play a role. So the thing is, if you're going to get on an airplane and go to an event, there better be something there that's just not walking around a trade show floor looking at cool things.
Right.
They have to create an environment that attracts an attendee beyond just the trade show. Now, there's seminars, there's networking, and there's exhibits. And for exhibits, in the medical industry in particular, most people who attend a medical conference are really not going there for the exhibits. They're going there to continue their continued education units. They have to go to sessions to get credits to keep their licenses. So that's their main reason. Their second reason is to network with other doctors. And the third reason is the trade show. And when they do a survey with medical attendees and they ask, what did you get from the show? They'll say, the exhibit. And back to that comment, a eureka moment. A doctor will walk the floor and all of a sudden he's talking to somebody invented this new process that changed the way we can do our business in our hospital. Eureka moment. And discovering that eureka moment happens all the time if you take the time to look for it. So when a doctor decides at a medical, we're talking about medical meetings now, or an administrator walks the floor, sees something, that's interesting. They uncover your eureka moment, and that's what they take back to their company as a valuable reason for going to the show, although it wasn't their motive to begin with. But what's changing, and you ask me what about the future, what's really important today is the location. And isn't that interesting in the United States? Chicago used to be the number one trade show city in the U.S. It still is on the top because of its size. But number one is Las Vegas.
Right.
Number two is Orlando. And why do you suppose? Mickey Mouse, gambling, those emotional influences that influence you to attend a show. And I think that component never was considered to be a serious one, but it is today. And we're talking about a younger audience that needs more than just to go to a location for the trade show.
Right.
Hey, it's in Las Vegas. Hey, it's in San Diego. What a cool city. Hey, it's in New Orleans. What a cool city. So San Diego's the new hot one now. These are cool cities that people know, hey, I want to go there. Now, if that's your reason, hey, that's okay. Because your real reason is what you might discover at a trade show and how that experience and how that organizer did a good job in developing an environment that made that whole trip worthwhile. That when you come back from that show, you should be charged with, wow, I'm so glad I went. And for personal reasons as well. I went and saw the Statue of Liberty when I went to New York. I saw something I never would have seen otherwise. So the future, we talk about emotion for our reason to buy. Well, emotion is also our reason to attend the show. And I think if those things continue to be valuable, then the life of trade shows for the power of face-to-face will continue, I say, for the next 20 years. Now, after that, I think technology is going to play a role with us that you and I just aren't aware of just yet.
True.
I mean, how comfortable am I? There will be times where we're talking right now and I'm looking at you. But what if I could reach out and just pat you on the back digitally?
Yeah.
What if I could take a break, go to the bathroom, and I'm still here?
Yeah, exactly.
Things of that nature that allow communication to not stop
sure.
and create emotion. because motion is important.
One thing I want to tell you, see, last year I spent time across 7-8 cities in North America talking to about 200 attendees.
Yeah. About what?
About what stood out in this trade show that you have attended just now. So obviously there are different trade shows and different kinds of attendees, different profiles, right? And I would say 95% of them said, the best thing that happened is that I bumped into somebody I had not met for 3 years. Not one person said that in that particular booth, I met such and such person or I saw such and such thing, which was really mind-blowing. Now, it's a very small sample. I'm not saying that this is a real reflection of what's going on in the world, but that's really what I heard. And I see what you're saying when you say that make it something wow worthy.
Right.
But unfortunately, it seems that exhibitors are not paying enough attention to do that. And they're not doing enough attention to actually connect their products or service to the attendee. They're very much into, oh, what can I do to have more footfall? So let's give away an iPhone or let's serve coffee. But the people who are coming for the iPhone or the coffee may not be your target customer at all.
Exactly. You bump into strangers that turn out to be longtime friends thereafter. You know, it's interesting in Europe, when they talk about what are three things you do when you design an exhibit in Europe, one is that they have raised floors. And a raised floor, I used to argue with European companies, oh, you know, we don't do raised floors in the United States. We use carpets and thick pads and, you know, carpets that are not even biodegradable, it's not whatever. But I finally asked, why do you want a raised floor? I can save you $10,000. He said, Larry, you don't understand. When you step up into a raised floor, you're walking into my kingdom. You're walking into my space. It's a valuable psychological. And I was always saying a raised floor was to hide the electric cords and to make the floor level, because with systems like Octonorm and systems, they have to have a level floor. Otherwise, the exhibit doesn't stand straight.
Right.
But the point of it, walk into my kingdom, is a very important component psychologically for European. The second is a bar. Having a bar is a place to go have a coffee. It's a safe zone.
Yeah.
When you don't go selling somebody who wants to have a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And that's the whole reason for having a bar. It's create a safe zone and work your way into the conversation.
Yeah,
don't
absolutely
force the, you know, what can I sell you? You know, you want a coffee with cream and sugar?
Yeah.
And in Europe, always with a sauce and a spoon. It's and glass, no paper cup.
Right.
It's just you can't walk away with that sauce, and you'll walk away with a paper cup.
Yeah.
So there's something said about having a bar that creates an environment that allows engagement to take place in a natural way. Now, it very well be that this engagement is, geez, I don't like this at all, I'm walking away. But I'd say more so than not, you're finding yourself interested in this person. Hey, they're at the show for the same reason you are. You know, there must be something to do with the industry. Otherwise, and put yourself into that situation to allow for those, as I keep calling them, eureka moments to take place. And don't have an agenda to say, I'm here to buy widgets. And when you said people walk away because they ran into somebody from years ago, that's so true. That comes back in their hearts as a valuable, geez, I'm so glad I went to the show and saw John once again.
And I
couldn't believe that he got things that he can buy from me.
right, exactly. And people would buy. It's not that, look, Larry, I can't sell you something that you don't want to buy.
Right.
No matter how smart I am, no matter what script I have been given, no matter which training I have taken, I cannot sell you something that you are not going to buy. What I can do is build enough. It's sort of like dealing with children, you know. You need to have the communication channel open. They should not shut you out.
Right. Well, with my little kids, you tell them they can't have something and they want it. So it's funny with the cars these days, how Tesla, you know, was the big popular car for all the people that wanted to stop production of gas and whatever. And all of a sudden they're against it.
Yeah.
Tell them they can't have it and they want it. And but I, you know, when I was sales manager for Greyhound Exhibit Group, this was back in Chicago. And I was asked the question, what's the difference between sales and marketing? You know, and the difference is marketing, the definition of marketing is to create a selling situation. Create a selling situation. Don't go into your, they call them elevator pitches immediately. And I always recommend, I had 175 salesmen who reported to me, seven different divisions. And I said, this was at a time when flying was pretty, everybody was flying. I said, upgrade to first class. Not because you're special, not because it's a more comfortable way to fly, but because it's very likely you're sitting next to another business traveler. And that business traveler, the exchange of business card, hey, what do you do for a living? And they may not be the marketing manager, but they'll pass your card. It's back in the day when people used to exchange cards to would pass it on. And I got more business just sitting and talking to somebody who wasn't the marketing manager, but he passed the card. And all of a sudden that marketing initiative, meaning putting yourself in a selling situation, means you're at a, as a business traveler, you're not threatened. But at one point they say, you know, I'm interested in that. Tell me more about it. Now you begin selling.
Yeah.
You set up the selling situation.
Yeah.
And that's the same with a trade show. You don't start and say, how can I sell, let me sell you my widgets here. You ask, what are your needs? What are your, what business are you in?
Right.
I'm a candy manufacturer. Well, figure out a way to say goodbye. There's an art to disengaging too as trade shows, but we'll get into that some other time, because there's a time where I'm not selling anything here.
Yeah.
It's not a good fit.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is enough tools available today to, once you figure out that this, I mean, it may not be even that you cannot sell today, but you may figure that he needs nurturing and information because he may be buying the next quarter. He may not be ready today. So you move it gently to a situation, like you said, where he can comfortably consume without the pressure of telling you that I am not buying now. Right? That's where the coffee and the bar comes in, that you let him be. You say, why don't you go through this material? Why don't you scan this thing and spend the time, right?
Well, it's getting back to my book.
Yeah.
Much of my book has nothing to do with what we're talking about right now, which is very, very important. Mm-hmm. It really has to do with how is it that we evolved to feel comfortable with trade shows and events as being, and invest the money that people do and companies do. Why do they continue to do so? And how did this happen? Is really what the book's purpose is.
Sure.
It just didn't come about. It evolved to be a $1 trillion contribution to economies, and the effect on trade shows is tremendous to the cities that host them.
Right.
They make money from the trade show. I'm talking about the cities that invested in the convention centers. But the money they make is from hotels, restaurants, all the peripheral spending that takes place aside from the event itself.
Right. Absolutely.
I think I represented the city of Chicago McCormick Place to promote come to Chicago to have your conventions. Now, this was back in the 80s. And their theme was attractions without distractions. And their meaning was Orlando, Las Vegas were an attraction, but they were a major distraction. Where at Chicago, it was a wonderful place, a wonderful business environment, when people came there strictly for that.
Yeah.
Well, those days are gone. People don't come strictly for that. They come for things other than that. And the location does matter.
Yeah. So, Larry, two quick questions before we wrap this up. One is, from your vast experience of designing exhibits and booths, what do you see is the future of design? That's question one. And question two, how do you see exhibiting companies can easily establish the ROI on their exhibition investment?
Well, those are two different questions, of course.
Yes.
Number one, we're investing in the marketing budget. Somebody's approving this marketing budget that is allowing people to spend the money within their companies to participate in a trade show. Now, when we say participate in a trade show, it doesn't necessarily mean just building an exhibit.
Right.
It means maybe being a sponsor for an event. It means having a side attraction of some sort or another. But the exhibit itself has to be, as Fred Kitzing say, an attraction. There has to be some form of, hey, you're for real, meaning don't having a draped back wall with a cardboard sign may be the cheapest way to go, but it's certainly not a good first impression. Mm. You know, talking about first impressions, people used to go to trade shows wearing a suit and a tie. They don't anymore, and for that matter, restaurants are getting on airplanes. It's a different society. So that's accepted. So if that's an accepted, then your exhibit has to look inviting. It has to be such that it's not threatening and create, and within it is an attraction. And that initial attraction might not be your product. You know, there's a lot of negative things about what they call booth babes. Booth babes are girls that were in the booth and say, here, would you like a pen? Another attraction would be in a magician. Now, these things have nothing to do with your product, but they had to do initially with why you stepped foot into that space. Now, if you got somebody to that point, then you better continue the interest to create emotion at one point or another.
But
then an exhibit has to have characteristics of professionalness and cleverness. Now, audiovisual and lighting and the things we can do with lasers is remarkable. Now, that's an attraction for a moment. But once you got somebody in that space and giving them how about a popcorn, or if getting somebody to sit down, now that's an achievement because they're in your space and they're feeling good. So now, let's create that selling situation, as I talked earlier. The marketing was creating the attraction and creating a reason, but getting the selling situation isn't an easy thing. Now, creating a selling situation could be done in advance. You send out a mailer and say, come to our space, and I got a free iPad for you. You know, people are, I hate to say it, will do things for stupid reasons. To get a free something. If that's what it takes, is it not worth a free iPad to get $1 million contract? I'd say, if in fact it translated that way. But the attraction part needs to be a strong component of exhibit design. And also telling people who you are. That's one of the biggest faults I've seen in European exhibitors. In the United States, we'll have a bold sign on the front. Xerox, the maker of, they tell you number one, who they are, and below it, what is our specialty. Where in Europe, you'll see a sign that's very low key. It'll say ABC company. That's not enough. Come on. Unless I really know who you are in advance, which a lot of people do, quite frankly. But you do have to have identity as an attraction. Maker, the leader in whatever. That word, the leader in whatever, is the reason you go visit that exhibitor.
Right.
Hey, I need that. I don't use you guys for my stuff, but you're the leader. Tell me more about why it is that you earned that title. So true. Attraction is a key there. Yeah. I think in the end, what our future is going to be less for more, meaning we're going to try and spend less and gain more. But gaining more is the measurable that I think is kind of hard to define at times. Right. I mean, why do we go to a show? It's to sell more. It's to gain market share. It's to all these things. But companies don't take the time to measure all the secondary benefits. Hey, I met a guy that we can hire in our East Coast operation. Right. Hey, I met this person who is looking to sell his company. Right. Why don't we buy them? There's a value to that what do I call it, engagement, that situation that you were put in. And those things need to be part of the measurement value when talking about what do we get from this show.
Absolutely.
And take the time to do it, because people, a lot don't. I can't believe so many companies, we used to collect the leads and they were paper and they'd put them into a bin and the exhibit would be shipped back.
Yeah.
And they never asked for that bin. Gosh, all your leads are in there. Aren't these important to somebody that my guys are checking out the exhibit. They get back. Here's all your leads a month later, you know. Mm. Why in the heck aren't you screaming to me, to say, Larry, send me that box of my leads?
Right.
It's just what, you know, when they're done, it's like, phew, we got through it. No, you're not through it. You're just starting. Get on those leads. That's what it was all about. If I was the head of this company, I'd be screaming at you.
PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers. Through its presentation and discussion modules, sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement process. PitchLink requires no installation or download, contains and manages the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without interruption. Connect with us on LinkedIn or visit tradeshowengage.com. That is tradeshowengage.com.
Larry, thank you so much. This is wonderful chatting with you about this book. And I would, we're still recording, so I would like to have you on record that you will come back and talk to me about the other book.
And, well, absolutely.
I
encourage our listeners, go on to my website, www.larrykulchewick.com. And there, I have many articles in there that are of interest within this industry. And also, it's a deeper review of both books within the website.
Larry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes featuring great conversations on engaging your booth visitors and maximizing your ROI from your trade show investments. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening. Thank you for being with us today on the Trade Show Podcast, the podcast of record for the trade show and events industry. Here we talk to movers and shakers of the $50 billion trade show industry and identify ideas, challenges, tactics, and strategies to leverage the first-party intent inherent in the trade show business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and implement some of the ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of the Trade Show Podcast. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platform like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast from, and give us a rating while you are at it. This is a Bizcast original podcast and is produced for PitchLink, the next generation visitor engagement platform, where our mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Shubhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.